South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. It's a very, very nice Sunday morning across the area. Some people got a good rain last night. Others, well, everybody got, I think, a little bit, but quite cool this morning. I don't know if you've been out, but you may just want to pick up a jacket. It was, I think, 48 as I was driving in this morning, and that's getting pretty chilly for the end of April. But other than the wind, it's just going to be a great day to get out and garden and do whatever. Just don't spend it inside. This is one of those days when you can really enjoy. And if you get just a little bit chilled, just, you know, console yourself that pretty soon you'll be wishing that it wasn't quite so hot. Lots of things to talk about, but of course the most important things are what are on your mind. I've got two open lines. Grab one of them if you like. You just heard the number, 210-599-5555. But we've got Dagny and Ron ready to talk. Dagny's first. Good morning.
Hi, Bob. Boy, you're right about the temperature. We just got back from walking the dogs. It's fabulous outside. Hey, I've got two questions about green beans.
Uh-huh.
Right? I've got provider green beans in my garden right now. The plants looked great up until about a week or two ago, started producing beans. And then suddenly the lower leaves, and not every lower leaf, but some of the lower leaves would just overnight turn bright yellow.
Mm-hmm. How often are you watering?
I do try to water when we don't have rain. I'm trying to water every other day.
Probably need to water every day, especially in the wind. And it's just like the whole leaf turns yellow. It's not a gradual thing. And the leaves above and below that point still hold a normal green color.
It's usually the lower leaves on the plant,
and they
turn bright yellow overnight.
Yeah.
And it's not every one. I'll pull off maybe a half dozen or a dozen bright yellow leaves every morning when I go out to check them.
They're either not getting watered thoroughly enough or often enough or maybe both. Are you watering by hand with a drip system? How does that part of your garden get watered?
You know, I do have to water by hand. I don't have a drip system. And I have noticed the soil doesn't seem to soak the water in.
Yep.
Because if I water for what I think is quite a long time, I stick my finger down and maybe the top inch is wet, but below that it's dry as a bone. So is there some way to get the water down deeper that's not a drip irrigation system?
Well, you could always put something that will catch and retain a bit of the water, like a layer of mulch, a layer of compost, will very much help. Products like Medina Soil Activator and Medina Plus work to soften the soil over time. It's not going to be an overnight thing. But probably the best thing you could do would be to put not right up against the base of the plants, but put maybe an inch of compost down. And once you get that moistened, it's going to make it much easier to hold the water in place, to get it slowly into the soil. Now, drip is a good possibility, and it's cheap and easy to install. It's not like little pieces of spaghetti tubing. It's just like a little slightly over half inch tube that has a built-in emitter every foot along it. And it is easy to put drip down. But in the meantime, just to, help hold the water. The other thing you can do, then I typically do this in my garden, is in effect make a sort of a furrow where along either side where you can sort of mound the dirt up that will just create a little pool around the base of the plants or just, mm-hmm. Two furrows down either side. But mm-hmm. all you're looking at is just the roots getting too dry. And you described it perfectly. The upper part is moist, but the roots of those green beans are, 3-4 inches down in the soil, and that's just not getting the moisture they need.
Okay, I just wasn't sure if it was a nutrient problem or a water problem. You made that real clear. My second question was, I'm growing provider beans. Mm-hmm. I know you've mentioned Contender quite often.
Right.
Is that a better bean to plant, and is it too late now to start some new bean seeds?
Not at all. In fact, you can't expect. Bush beans are extraordinarily productive. I've never grown provider, but off of a 3-foot row, you should be able to pick one or two servings of beans practically every day, and mm-hmm. But they don't go on for a long time. You get probably 6 or maybe 8 weeks picking. And Contender is, I actually like one called Tavera for my early season bean. It's just so tender and has a little bit better flavor, I think. But when we get into summer.
What is that one again?
It's called Tavera, T-A-V-E-R-A. And I usually plant that one in March, and it will go on till probably June. And boy, talk about a heavy producer and a really good bean. But then as we get into the hotter weather, when those plants start playing out, I'll plant Contender. You can count on them probably going up until early August, and then you can plant another batch of Contender, or Top Crop is another heat-tolerant one. But if you really like beans, you're probably going to plant three crops of them during the summer, because they just don't, you know, they just kind of wear themselves out after about 3 months of production. But they're excellent beans and should be very easy for you to grow. As it gets hotter and drier, the one issue you could possibly have is spider mites, and they're going to be an issue if you don't get that water situation corrected. But you can either spray preventatively with a mixture of seaweed and molasses. The seaweed sort of toughens the leaf where the mites can't get to it, but that's about the only thing. I mean, you may have a caterpillar, you may have a grasshopper show up occasionally, but spider mites are the only thing that will keep you from you know, eating green beans 2 or 3 times a week through the entire summer.
Yeah, you know, I had a cricket that I think took out one of my bell pepper plants the other day. So they're out there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, thank you so much. That really helps. I'll have to get on that water issue.
Right, and if you decide that you want to put in a drip system, what you want to ask for is something called pressure-compensated drip tubing. And it's remarkable. You're probably going to pay 60 or 80 cents a foot for it, so it's not very expensive. And this little emitter they've got on there is just remarkable in that it, no matter how long your run is, no matter how much drip you have, I've had probably maybe 150-foot run of drip irrigation, and you get exactly the same amount of water out of the last emitter as you do out of the first emitter. You compare that to a soaker hose, which probably puts out 80% of its water in the first 20% of the hose. The pressure compensated drip from Rainbird is just, I love it. It just, and I have a little bit bigger garden, although I really haven't planted as much as usual. This has been such a busy year. But I even put mine on a sprinkler system controller, and so that it would come on automatically even when I have to make the occasional market trip or the, you know, pleasure trip to go fly fishing in Wyoming or something like that. It waters the garden for me without having to ask a neighbor to do it. But at some point it would be a good improvement. It might be something that a wise lady would ask for Mother's Day, or at least a gift certificate to go
That might actually be coming up pretty quickly here, huh?
That just might be coming up pretty quickly. Mother's Day is a great day for all you ladies to celebrate, and for us, it'll make the 43rd anniversary of our nursery, so we remember Mother's Day very fondly around here. But drip systems are just, I do not like the ones that have the little spaghetti tubing that you plug into a bigger line, because there's so much calcium in our water. I've had problems that they just plug up.
Yeah.
But I've had some of this drip down for, 4 years now. And I find that the little connectors, little L's and T's and things you use to create your system, if they're out in the sun, they get brittle after a couple of years. But the tubing seems to last, you know, for quite a few years. So it would be a great gift and a good investment.
That sounds like great advice. Listen, thanks so much, and you enjoy a wonderful day.
I sure plan on it. You do the same, and let's move on and see what Ron's up to today. Good morning, Ron.
Yeah, good morning, Bob. I have two unrelated topics.
Okay.
I'm the guy who, I don't know if you got them, I sent you some photographs. I had talked to you about what I call a Uvalde smoker.
Okay, yeah.
And I sent you a photograph of that just so you could see what it looked like.
Okay.
And I sent you a photograph of a white mountain laurel. I don't know how rare those are, but I'm the guy with the ranch between Lake and Camp Wood, and it's 315 acres, and without exaggeration, we probably have 5,000 mountain laurels, and that's one of the very few white ones Yeah. I've seen. So is a white mountain laurel very rare?
I wouldn't go so far as to call it rare. I would call it uncommon, as is a pink mountain laurel. I have one of each in my yard, and I was just at one of my growers one day when they were in bloom, and I went through probably 500 plants and said, you know, I want these two and these two, because I was able to go through and just pick out the less common colors. But not rare, but it's kind of like, you know, other colored bluebonnets, the maroon bluebonnets, the white bluebonnets are not unheard of, but you probably see 200 of the more common ones for each one of the unusual ones that you see.
Yeah, this one's not pink. It's white. I mean, it is white. And it's one of the few. I mean, I can't get over the whole property because it's so steep and you have to do it on foot. And then the third photograph was a magnolia tree in my yard. I live in Alma Heights, just to show you how big it was. We live in a two-story house, and it's much taller than the house. It's one of the biggest, best magnolias in the area. I just thought you'd be interested to see that.
Well, I haven't gotten those yet, but I'll speak to one of our managers and see that I get them. My former mother-in-law lived over in Larkwood in Alamo Heights and had a beautiful magnolia in her yard as well. So you've got some, you know, if you've got deep soil, you can grow a good magnolia. But if you live in Stone Oak, forget it.
Yeah, I think this was an old area that they said it was a horse barn or something at one time back in the 1800s or early days. And then the question I have is, our daughter planted a very small chinquapin oak, and it's only like 3 feet tall. The trunk is barely bigger than a pencil. So she bought a very small one in a pot, but she said the roots were girdled, and they didn't cut the roots. They pulled them apart. And I don't know how they planted it. I don't know if they backfilled it with a little bit of growing green or I don't know what they did. But anyway, it's barely growing. And my question is, when it's dormant, can you pull it up or dig it up, cut the roots, and replant it? Would that make sense?
Pulling the roots apart may be, you know, enough to stop the problem. What I would begin by doing is, once again, in cooler weather, I probably would take my hose, since not many people have an air spade lying around, and just wash the soil away. Temporarily wash the soil away 4 or 5 inches deep down around the root ball so that you can examine it without going to the, you know, extreme of actually pulling it out of the ground. Plants really absorb very little through their roots per se, but their roots are covered with little microscopic things called root hairs that actually do most of the absorption of nutrient and water. And those are very delicate. You know, if you start digging, start messing around with them too much, you'll damage those, even if you just take it out and put it right back in the ground. So I would want to, you know, take a look at it and see if it's really necessary to go all the way to pulling it out, cutting some of them. If they unwound them successfully, if they spread them out, that may be all that it needs.
Yeah, that's just what they said. They just said we pulled them apart. But the tree, I actually saw the tree. It's got some green growth, but it's very small. And maybe they just bought it's so young, it's just not taking off yet. But they said it's been in the ground for over a year.
Well, chinquapins are not known for fast growth. And we're just now getting into the season, you know, that they would really be expected to start putting on growth. I wouldn't expect more than 8 to 10 inches of growth out of it this year, but just watch it carefully. In any event, you're not really going to want to do anything that messes with the roots until the weather cools off this fall. So suggest that they get some Hastagrow plant or Medina's liquid fish blend or both, and give that plant a good dose of liquid fertilizer every 2 to 4 weeks, and let's see what it looks like by the end of the summer.
Yeah, that's good advice. I have a big, big chinquapin. It's my favorite oak tree, actually, on the ranch. And I planted one of the acorns about 4 or 5 years ago. And that tree, I started in a pot. And that tree's probably 15 feet tall now. It really, I just picked the right acorn and in the right place. Of course, I fertilize it and water it where it's close to my cabin. But anyway, okay. Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate your advice.
One other thing, if you like planting things from seed, go put, you know, a piece of flagging or something on the white mountain laurels and maybe collect some seed from those if you get an opportunity and plant them. And probably a small percentage of them will come true and will come out white. They certainly won't all because of good old Mendelian genetics. But if you, you know, if you really want to do something that would be fun, it would be plant, you know, a dozen or two seeds from the white mountain laurels, let them grow and mature, and then the ones that do turn out white, or the one that does turn out white, collect some seed and replant that. And if you do this for four or five generations, you'll get to the point where you're getting a higher and higher percentage of the seedlings that come true with that white color, and you have yourself a nice little bargaining tool if you want to trade for other plants, yeah, or if you want to have something to sell. But
yeah, I wish I'd done that, because they, you know, they've quit blooming, and I wouldn't be able to figure out which one.
Okay.
I know the area that it is. I know it's right off of a ranch road, but yeah, that's good advice. I wish I'd thought of that when it was blooming, because I might be able to find it based on a photograph I took of it. I kind of know where it is.
Well, that would be it. Just would be
that
fun.
Would be, yeah, that'd be fun to try.
It would be
well,
fun
you,
to try. Mountain laurels are so interesting. They grow all over my ranch, which is west of Burney. And I've got some of them where the soil's deeper that are very large trees. I've got one hillside that probably the soil's less than an inch deep, and it is just a ground cover of mountain laurels. It is a solid mass of mountain laurels that have never grown more than about 18 inches tall. But they bloom in the spring, and it's just, it's like you can't see the dirt for all the mountain laurels and all the flowers, but the plants are so starved, being on such thin soil, that that's just as big as they've been able to grow, but they're just as healthy as can be, which speaks to the hardiness of and durability of mountain laurels. So, interesting tree, no doubt, and just one little interesting factoid that quite a number of years ago, apparently the seeds have some hallucinogenic properties, and some of our wonderful politicians, just shows you the intelligence level hasn't changed much. But there was a movement in Austin to try to destroy all the mountain laurels in the state to protect us from what people might be doing with the seeds of them.
Oh, save us from the politicians. Well, the mountain laurels were really beautiful this year, as you know. And,
yes,
and
they
the
were.
As well. They were really pretty this year. Well, that's really great. By the way, I also have some pinyon pines, and one of them's big enough to produce pine nuts.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's yeah. Unusual. I don't know if it was you or somebody else sent me the article on pinyons, because I lived in Albuquerque.
It was an interesting article
and just proof that if you have the right conditions, that you can grow them. So enjoy them. Pine nuts are wonderful things, and it kind of, for me, brings back memories of going out and collecting them. I don't remember exactly where we did, but it was somewhere that people had large numbers of them, and they were happy for people to go in and collect the cones and separate out the nuts. So, you got fun stuff. And listen, it's good to talk to you. Get out and enjoy this good weather. Did you get any rain last night?
Not here at the house, hardly any, no. I heard some thunder, but I didn't get much rain.
Yeah, I got like a quarter of an inch. My partner over toward Bergheim had like 0.8 inches. So glad to say a few people around got a good rain out of it. But you get out and have a good weekend, and I know we'll talk again.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Ron. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's get a break in here, and Susan and Robert will be my next callers. And looks like I get to talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center. And Fanix has a big event going on this weekend. Just almost every weekend they're going to be doing something this year, because it's their 85th year in business. If you go to the website, fanixnursery.com, you can see a list of all the upcoming events, both sales and programs. Well, anyway, this weekend is 20% off on all the Espoma products. Espoma was probably the original manufacturer of organic fertilizers in the United States, and they make quite a range of things and make a very top-quality product. If you like Espoma products, you can head over to Fanix today and stock up for 20% off the regular price of those things. Fanix is also well-stocked on trees. We've been talking about trees, and you know that Green Tree Shade rebate program CPS Energy offers, where they give you $50 credit per tree. That ends the end of April. That's just about 10 days away, so you would be well advised to get out and get some of the trees. Phoenix carries a large number of the ones that qualify for the program. They also have a new shipment of various kinds of fruit trees, nut trees. They've got grapes. They've got berries. They're just well-stocked. You can do that when you have 10 acres of nursery, and they also have all the organic products that you've been looking for, plus things like the Traeger pellet grills and the great Eco lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor equipment. It's always a good day to go see Phoenix. Sitting right over there on Home Green Road, right where they've been for 85 years. Check out the website at Phoenix, F-A-N-I-C-K, PhoenixNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550, KTSA, and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. Looks like we've got some open phone lines. If you were getting a busy signal there for a couple of minutes, would be a real good time to dial. You know the number, 210-599-5555. Well, I say good morning to Robert. Good morning, Robert.
This is Susan.
Susan, okay, well, very good. I got my got my list mixed up here. Good morning, Susan, and then we'll talk to Robert. How can I help you today?
I have two questions.
Okay.
The first is that we have bluebonnets in huge numbers in our backyard, which is
very
great.
Good.
I've never ever had that before.
Mm-hmm.
The downside is that half of them have sprouted up through, we have like a flagstone walkway.
Uh-huh.
Up the side of our yard, and they've come up through, you know, between the flagstones.
Okay.
Which I'm fine with too, but I now see seed pods, like big fuzzy, I'm assuming they're seed pods underneath
the blooms.
That's correct. Yep. Or below the blooms.
Yeah, they're
like what?
They're basically a bean, and I'm sure you've done green beans or shell peas, things like that, and they are a legume, and that's exactly what you're looking at.
Okay, and I heard you talk with a lady yesterday about her bluebonnets. The mm-hmm. seeds are inside that outside fuzzy sac.
Correct.
And what do I do now to be able to have the seeds? I understand you plant them next fall.
Yeah, normally you plant them in October or so because, as you probably observed on them this year, they have two different life stages, so to speak. The first is a small rosette of leaves, which it tends to form fall and through the winter. And then as it starts to warm, then it sort of shoots up out of the middle and produces their second life stage, which is those beautiful blooms that were so abundant this year. And you just need to wait until that seed pod's probably green and fuzzy now. It's going to turn yellow and then eventually brown. Once it has really started to yellow, this is a sign that the seed is probably mature, and if you're anxious to get those ones out of your sidewalk, you can harvest them at that point. If you want to make it a little bit easier, wait until the seed pod is brown and approaching being brittle. You don't want to wait too long because it will burst open and scatter the seed on its own once it gets fully dried out. But once it's gotten good and yellow and just started to dry, at that point you can go through and harvest as many of the seed pods as you like. You can open them, just kind of pull that little green edge. It's kind of like a string along the edge, and you can open them and just, you know, kind of scoop the seed out with a thumbnail, or you can let them dry and then you can basically just crack them open, and the brown seed will be inside. Each little seed pod's probably going to have about, a minimum of four, maximum of probably eight seeds in there. And collect away. You'll never get them all. Visiting with Bill Thomas, who owns, it's John Thomas that owns Wild Seed Farms. They designed a special machine to go through and harvest the seed. He said they figure that they collect about 400 pounds of seed per acre, and they actually only get about a third of the seed. So you're going to have quite an abundant crop.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say when we moved here last year, the ones that were coming up through the flagstones, I didn't know what mm-hmm. they were when they were that little rosette of leaves.
Right.
So I pulled them all.
Okay.
And then this year I realized what they were, and So then what about transplanting the plants that are in the walkway?
Once they have bloomed, the plants are going to die. They bloom, they make seed. They're what we call a biennial. They go through their two life stages, and then that's it. They are not perennials. They don't come back from the existing plant. So once you've harvested the seed, I mean, if you like the green foliage, you can leave it alone, but it's never going to do any more than it has, and it will eventually turn brown and die this summer regardless of what you do. So I would harvest the seed and then just pull up the plants if you want to make the walkway a little bit neater.
Okay, and then keep the seeds cool and dry over the summer?
Cool and dry is the perfect thing to do. You have a great Christmas present material if you like. If you have a yard full of bluebonnets, you've got that much seed, you have a very valuable resource. It's the seed has been a little scarce and a little expensive. Unfortunately, a lot of people wind up buying seed not knowing what they're getting. There are actually, I think, 8 different kinds of bluebonnets grow in Texas, and some of them really don't do nearly as well, and you don't know what you're, unless you're dealing with somebody like Wild Seed Farms, you're not ever sure that you're getting the right type of bluebonnet. But you obviously have one that does extremely well here, and I think anyone on your Christmas gift list would feel honored to get a package of your bluebonnet seed.
Well, I'm excited that they thrive on pretty much doing nothing with them. So
thrive
great.
On neglect is the best way to put it.
Great. Then I can do that. And my second question is I would like to start a compost pile. Mm-hmm. So some guidance on how to get that started.
Well, basically, you just want a place that you can pile up stuff and let it rot is what composting comes down to. It's an art as well as a science, and basically anything living can be added to the compost pile. The more different things that you put into it, the more diversity of microbes you'll get, and that's what compost is about. It's nice to have the organic material that it produces, but the magic that compost works in your yard is just through the diversity of microbes. And it's a different set of microbes that, you know, break down bluebonnet plants than what would break down banana peels and what would break down grass clippings and what would break down tree leaves. And the really good compost companies may use 20 or 30 different feedstocks making their compost. Now, you can make good compost with nothing more than grass clippings and leaves, but you can also put all your kitchen scraps in. I don't recommend putting meat in because you'll bring in some varmints that you probably don't want to deal with. And although it would not hurt to add pet waste to the compost pile, it takes a little longer to break down, and you're not quite as anxious to get down and run your hands through the soil through your compost. But basically, you know, any sort of kitchen scraps, leaves, small twigs, grass clippings, and all the stuff that your stupid neighbors put out on the curb for the trash people to pick up. I have a friend here who used to work with the botanical garden. He called me one time and said, please tell my neighbors thank you for putting all those bags of leaves out on the curb, because I've got the most incredible yard and the most incredible compost pile ever just from what they're throwing away. So you know, we don't turn compost piles frequently. We used to think that if you went out every day and turned them, you'd be getting better compost. You're actually getting worse compost, because when you turn frequently, you break up a lot of the beneficial fungi that are growing in there. So it basically, even the biggest compost producers out there are using what they call a static pile method, which means just putting your material in, being sure it's moist. If you want to throw a little bit of finished compost in just to bring in, you know, a good inoculant as far as the microbes go, if you want to add a little bit of molasses or sugary things to really kick up the microbial activity, you can do all of those things. But then just basically, you know, let it sit for a while, and you'll wind up with good compost. I always have two piles going. I'm filling one pile, and then when that gets full, I'll start filling the second one and let the first one cook for a while, so to speak. By the time I've got the second one full, I can probably go back and harvest compost out of the first pile and just rotate back and forth. If you have a lot of material, you might want to create three piles. If you want to, you can bend a little piece of fencing in a circle and keep it contained in there. If you want to just leave it as a pile, it will break down, and it will break down whether you do anything or not. But if you want to speed it up, keeping it moist, adding some molasses or another sugary product, Malcolm Beck got the Coca-Cola company to give him all of the waste material, their sugary material that didn't get used. And so anything high in sugars will speed up the decomposition. And beyond that, give it some time and you'll be making better stuff than you can buy.
And then do I need to crunch up leaves?
The more surface, you know, the more surface area you create, the faster they will break down. So you don't have to. Mother Nature doesn't. But if you, the more you can shred them up, you know, you probably will create, you know, 10, 15 times as much surface area on the leaf that are the sites where your microbes get started breaking things down. So mulching them up a bit will help them break down faster. Is it absolutely necessary? No. Will it give you more compost more quickly? Yes.
Okay, and what about weeds? Like, I have a neighbor, we have a wrought iron fence between us and our neighbor, and they have some of the meanest vines with, like, stickers, and they're very enthusiastic, but they are awful. But I don't put stuff like that in compost, do I?
You certainly can if you want to. You don't have to worry about seeds. Your compost pile is going to heat up to probably 180 degrees, which is going to destroy any seeds that are in there. Now, there's some tough things like this vine called smilax. It grows up in the hill country and is quite spiny and slow to break down. But, no, weeds and things are fine to throw in there because it's going to basically cook the seeds and everything so that you don't have to worry about, you know, propagating, moving weeds around that way.
Oh, great. Okay, I can do that.
Well, you get out there and do it, and today would be a great day to get started because it's a very pleasant temperature, and call if you have questions as you go along.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob.
You're welcome, Susan. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And Robert, you'll be next, but I need to get a break in here. Looks like I get to talk about azomite, and I love talking about azomite. All natural product. It's an ore that's mined, I think it's in Nevada, but just as this earth was forming, as the volcanoes melted and mixed liquid rock and things, the azomite came out just as one of the materials that contains the largest number of micronutrients and micronutrient compounds of any other thing that I know. It's not man-made. All man does is to grind it down or break it down into a smaller particle size. Azomite you can get as a sort of about like fertilizer granules, about that consistency that you can put out with a spreader or you can scatter around by hand. It also comes in what we call a micronized form, where it is ground down to such a fine powder that you can actually put it into suspension in a sprayer as long as you keep shaking it and actually spray it out. What it does, it meets all the micronutrient needs of your plants. If you have plants that are yellowing from lack of iron or zinc, it's amazing how it will green them up. And like I say, you're never going to burn with it. It doesn't have to be watered in. It is a product that is totally safe for people and pets, and it does work wonders. I like to use it as a soil amendment when I'm getting ready to plant either flower beds or vegetable garden. Also use it to kind of green up plants that have a tendency to yellow. Look for it at your favorite nursery garden center. It's called Azomite.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right. It looks like Robert's phone quit on him again, so it's going to be Carlos and TJ and Alisa. Carlos is up first. Good morning, Carlos.
Good morning, Bob. How are you today?
Morning, sir. Off to a good start after a rain last night, so everything's beautiful.
Well, I think we got just a little bit of rain here in Brownsville, Texas, and we're getting some nice cool weather out of the northeast, so it's a beautiful Sunday morning.
It certainly is. The wind could die, but it sure feels good to be outside.
Yep, it sure is. Calling you because I have a concern with my Myers lemon.
Okay.
In spring when the new leaves started to come out, it was nice and green, beautiful. It was flowering, had a lot of flowers on it. Right now, most of the flowers have dropped off. I have about 9 lemons growing.
Okay.
But the leaves are starting to get yellow from the edges inward. I've tried azomite, I've tried molasses, fish emulsion, worm castings.
Is this tree in the ground or is it in a pot?
It's in the ground.
Okay. I you know, think more than anything, I just give it a little time. How often do you water, and do you water by hand, or how are you watering the tree?
Usually you get the watering hose and put on there slow so it soaks in. My soil has a lot of clay in it, so you need to water slowly.
Right.
And I usually leave it for 30 minutes or so once a week.
Okay. I think that you may need, unless the water is really running off, you may need to leave it for an hour. The tree may just not be getting watered thoroughly enough, and it sounds like it's a mature tree. It's been in the ground for some time.
It's been in the ground for about at least 6 years.
Yeah. You've done everything.
And it survived.
Okay. Very good. You've done everything that I could think of to be sure it has the nutrients that it needs to grow. At this point, I would, every 2 or 3 weeks, I would fertilize either with Has to Grow or the Medina Liquid Fish Blend. But you need to feel the soil. Don't water until the soil feels like it's dry, at least an inch deep. But it takes a plant, especially in clay soils, it takes a plant a little time to absorb and make use of all the good things that you have put on it. So only change I would make is I think I would water a little longer when you do so. And let me know how it looks by early summer. It's probably just starting to put on its new leaves. Are you starting to get some new leaf growth on it at this point?
Yes, I am. And those look nice and green.
Okay, well, that tells me what I was just about to ask. If the new growth is looking good, then everything's getting better. The older leaves, just due to the nature of citrus, the older leaves may or may not change a little bit. If anything's going to change them, it's going to be azomite. You've already put that on there. So at this point, if the new growth looks good, other than, you know, perhaps watering a little bit more thoroughly when you water, I just give it some time. It sounds to me like your tree's on the rebound. I don't hear any real cause for concern there.
Okay. Well, just one final comment on the azomite. It's a wonderful product. I put it on all my plants, and, boy, they green up really fast, and the blooms are, I mean, the colors are so vibrant.
I'm sorry the citrus is a little bit more stubborn and doesn't show the response, but I'm not surprised, and I'm really happy that you're seeing real good results with it on other things. So I think the main thing you need is patience. I think the one thing that tree might need is just a little more thorough watering. I don't think it needs it any more often, but maybe just let it run a little bit longer, water a little bit deeper, and it should come around for you. But the fact that the new growth is looking good, that tells me things are well under control.
Just as comparison, next to this Myers Lemon, I have a navel orange, and I have another orange tree. And with the azomite, they're full of fruit right now. They're loaded with fruit.
Good.
They're nice and green. So it works.
It works. Myers Lemon is just a little stubborn. It's worth the effort because I think it's the best lemon on the market. But you're doing it right. Just keep it up, and it will come around for you.
All right. Thank you for the advice, Bob.
You're sure welcome, Carlos. Thank you. All right. Got to get a break in here before the top of the hour. It looks like I get to talk about Rhonda's Nature's Way. And, you know, just like the trees and things that he was describing, your body reacts when you give it good things. And you don't get everything you need in today's diet. Just about everybody will look better, feel better, and, you know, have more resistance to disease and things like that if you're making certain that you get all the micronutrients that you need, all the vitamins and minerals, and so much of it just isn't in our food supply today. Well, Rhonda's has supplements that will help you be sure you're getting everything you need based on your gender, your age, and your level of activity. Everybody's a little bit different, and that's why you can't just go to the grocery store or chain pharmacy and buy something off the shelf and think that it's going to be really great for you. Rhonda will you take the time to get to know you and figure out what's going to help you feel good, feel better. If you've got problems like allergies, she has a product called Seasonal Allergy Relief that works really well. She's got things to help with issues with digestion or sleeping, and not prescription medication. These are natural products that have no side effects, and you don't have to worry about drug interactions. Plus, she does reflexology. The lady and her staff just have so much knowledge that she can certainly help you get healthy and stay healthy. And speaking of help around the shop, I think she's looking for one or two good part-time people who would really like to learn about this and need a part-time job. Why don't you go talk to Rhonda? Her store is over in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, right there kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. It's a wonderful place to visit and a way to feel better naturally. She's closed on Sundays, by the way. Can't go today, but Monday through Saturday, go see Rhonda over at Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to the phone lines. TJ's next. TJ, let's get started. If we run into the news break, we'll just hold you through that and continue. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
I have a goofy question first. Is Jimmy wearing a suit and tie like he was on Friday, or that was just a special Friday?
And you no, didn't, that was just that special Friday, TJ.
Okay. Question is, I have the mulberry tree. My mulberry tree went crazy this year, and it does generate a lot of trash.
Right.
And now, all the trash is good stuff that I can put in my compost, as I've been listening. But,
absolutely.
I'm sure it's going to give me a lot of trees that I'm going to have to pluck and whatever, right?
It may, it typically, the mulberry seeds sprout after they have passed through a bird's intestines, so it's not like you're going to have a forest of little trees coming up right underneath your mulberry tree, but you may have some sprout in the flower beds and other places around.
Okay, all right. Alrighty. Because I happened to post it online, I'm like, hey, I have all this huge bounty. And everybody's like, hey, we want some.
Sure.
And somebody wanted a little tree, and I'm like, okay.
Well, so, you can see what comes up, but normally they're activated, so to speak. What it amounts to is that the seed, the outer part of the seed coat, is softened up by some things that are in the bird's and digestive tract. And it's like, peppers and other things. They just sprout better once they've been processed, so to speak. And you'll almost certainly have some of them come up around in your flower beds.
Okay, excellent. Now, and my other question, I'll leave you be, the asparagus. I had started asparagus a couple of years ago.
TJ, do this. Let me get Jimmy to put you on hold, and we'll come back and talk about it. I'm only about 5 seconds away from news, and I have to get out on time. You're on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, let's get back to gardening and move on to with TJ's question. So tell me about your asparagus, TJ.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can I go back to the mulberry question?
You can go as far back as you like. Just hit rewind.
The roots are exposed, exposed quite a bit on that tree. I had chickens around there, and they just did their chicken thing, and they exposed all my roots. And my husband's concerned that they're too exposed.
No, it would be very, very hard on a tree like a mulberry to have them, too exposed. The tree is going to be much happier. If you want to put a little more soil over the roots but not up against the trunk, it won't hurt anything, but I really don't think it's necessary. What I would probably do is get a bag of mulch, which is in many ways more useful than soil. The mulch will help reduce weeds. It'll help keep the soil temperature down. And I just put a bag or two of mulch over around the base of that tree and forget about adding any more soil. I just don't think you need to.
Excellent. All right. Thank you. As to the asparagus, I started them from seed, and they made it. I did not procrastinate this time around. I put them in the ground, and they made it through the winter. But they're very wispy. Okay, they're not something you're gonna pull out and eat. So what do I do? Do I leave them be, as they are?
You feed them. You water them, you get very, very patient with them, because most asparagus crowns that are sold, most asparagus plants that are sold, are already 3 years old. So it takes them 2 or 3 years to start getting the bigger shoots. Now, chances are you will have lots and lots of big shoots, but not for a couple of years. So at this point, you just want to give them the best root system they can possibly get. You're going to leave the tops grow on them through the summer into the fall. If they get too tall, you may need to kind of prop them up a little bit so the wind doesn't break them. But at this point, they're just little kids that have to grow up before they can make make an impact and have nice big fronds or nice big spears of asparagus. So just a little patience and plenty of fertilizer and water.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So that was it.
Well, I understand you're a regular listener to KTSA Radio, and we do appreciate that, and I appreciate your call this morning, TJ. Get out and enjoy.
Thank you,
and goodbye. Alisa is up next. Good morning, Alisa.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. It's a beautiful morning out there. Glad that the temperature decided to get cooler instead of hotter this time around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to warn you, I'm getting over COVID, so if I hit the mute button, it's because I'm coughing. So.
Oh, okay. Well, I was afraid I was going to catch it from listening to you here on the show. I'm teasing you. I hope you get over that very quickly. And let's get started. We'll be patient.
Okay. I'm sorry. I have a very nice lady at a local grocery store who gives me her cast off of food that's deteriorated, the vegetables and stuff that she can't sell anymore. And so I've been throwing them in my compost pile. Uh-huh. And the other day I noticed some nice, really nice leafy greens popping up. And I realized I'm growing potatoes in my compost pile. And it's beautiful, but I'm afraid to touch it now. I don't want to turn it, or my dad's real excited. They're the little nugget ones, the small ones.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if I should just leave it alone or do anything with it.
Just leave it alone, water periodically, add a little bit of liquid fertilizer if you would like. That's fun. And the modern way of making compost doesn't involve turning the pile more than every few months. It's called static pile composting, and people are finding that it makes much better compost than it does when you turn it too often. So do not disturb those potatoes. Now, what you're going to find is that with a little time, they're going to make potatoes that are practically up on the surface of the compost, and they're going to make bigger potatoes deeper down. You don't want the potatoes, the ones that form up high, you don't want sunlight to hit them. That causes chlorophyll to develop, and it basically ruins it as something you want to eat. So just look at the base of the plant every now and then, and if you see what look like little tops of potatoes starting, put a little more compostable material on top of it. Periodically, you can kind of probe down in there with your index finger. When they get up to a size that you would like to eat, I mean, potatoes don't ripen per se. And you can lots of times harvest several little potatoes from around the base of the plant. Now, when we get into hot summer weather, the potato top is probably going to die and start to fall over. And at that point, you will dig out and harvest the larger potatoes, even though they're not going to be great big, but you're going to harvest larger potatoes who are right directly under the plant. So this is going to be a fun experiment for you, and you may just decide you want to grow potatoes intentionally instead of accidentally next time.
Well, it was just a surprise to see them pop up. And
isn't that fun?
I've been told I can also eat the leaves of the potato plant, or should I just leave that alone?
I would leave that alone. The potatoes are in the nightshade family, the solanums, and typically foliage is poisonous on a lot of these things, not necessarily
okay.
deadly, but, you know, it includes tomatoes and peppers and especially things like potatoes, so probably wouldn't be eating the foliage. I would stick to what's down below ground level.
Okay. All right. I have one more question, if that's okay.
Yes, ma'am.
My carrots, the tops of them are getting long, but they're not real bushy, and I'm not seeing any upgrowth. You know, I don't see anything popping up out of the ground. How bushy do those things need to get before I start pulling on them? Or do I need to see the top of them? Or?
Yeah, like your potatoes, take your index finger and just probe around. There's so many different kinds of potatoes, some of which are – oh, they kind of like people. Some of them are short and fat, and some of them are long and skinny. And you just, which ones you get will depend on what variety you planted. And just, you know, use your index finger to kind of probe around. You should be thinning those plants out. I suspect if you're getting roots forming, you're already doing that. But a lot of times people leave their carrots too close together and they end up with all top and not much in the way of a carrot underneath. So, be sure that you've thinned them properly. Carrots don't really ripen per se. They just keep getting bigger up to a point. If you leave them too long, they get kind of pithy. They kind of lose some quality. So if you got a big patch of them periodically, you probably just want to pull one and see how big it is and, you know, have it for dinner. But it takes, typically 2 to 3 months to really grow a mature carrot, but just probe around and see. You can harvest them and eat them at any point, so just get them out, let them get up to the size that you like.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, sir.
Always a pleasure. I do thank you for the call this morning. Goodbye. All right. Let's go ahead and take one more call before we take a break, and that would be John. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
Couple of things. I talked to you a couple of weeks ago about solarizing an area of my backyard to get rid of the nut grass and stuff, and got 3/4 inch of rain, but we have 3 days of cool. Is it too early to do that now?
Yeah. You need, you know, when you need the weather to get so hot that you wouldn't want to leave your car closed up on a parking lot just because it'd be too hot to get into. That's what solarizing is all about. You're ultimately going to cover that area with plastic, and you want it to heat up to a high temperature underneath it. And right now, with this little cool front blowing through with the north wind, it's going to be a while before we're going to have bright enough, hot enough sun for solarizing to work.
So even like next week, they're saying thunderstorms and 86 degrees. I mean, to me, if my dark truck were left out and I got in it in 86 degrees with the windows up, it'd be hot enough that I wouldn't feel like being in it very long. But is that time, or do I don't know that we'll have a good rain and warm temperatures, you know, once we get into summer.
Well, you know, summertime is really the time for solarizing. You would like it to be so hot that when you open the door of that truck, you said, I'm going to let that air out for 2 or 3 minutes before I got in.
Yeah.
Not just, gee, that's a little uncomfortable. You want it to be really, I mean, you want it to feel like an oven in there, because that's what you're basically doing, is just roasting, you know, your weeds,
right,
your nut sedge and things like that. So most people don't attempt solarizing until July or August, but you never know with Texas weather. If we get hot, bright weather, you can certainly do beforehand. But remember, you're wanting to heat the soil, not just on the surface, but, you know, 2-3 inches down into the soil. And that takes a pretty good amount of heat.
Sure. Okay. I'm kind of eager, because who knows if we're going to rain at all this summer.
Oh, I'm with you 100%. But again, some of the better things in life just can't be rushed.
Okay. Another thing, I have some potted plants that put herbs in, or herb seeds, and really haven't had much result with them growing. I don't know if they were old seeds or what, but on one of them that I do have some basil growing in. I've developed a fungus. I went out and watered the other day, and just a cloud of brown spores flew off. And the fungus is brown, looks almost like the seaweed that grows on the jetties, you know, down to the coast. Smaller than that, but what would take care of that?
Well, if you want to get rid of it, just a little sulfur dusted in there or a little whole ground cornmeal. But keep in mind, just like bacteria, there are more beneficial fungi than there are pathogenic, damaging fungi. So this may not be a bad thing. And if your basil's growing well, I'd advise that you just don't worry about it. So if you want to get rid of it, again, throwing a little whole ground cornmeal on there will develop a beneficial fungus called trichoderma, which tends to wipe out the damaging fungi, or just a very small amount of what they call dusting sulfur. Just dust it over the pot. The sulfur is a natural fungicide, and that should pretty much get it under control. But just bear in mind, you might be killing out something good rather than something harmful. So, and the other comment that I would make about growing things from seed, there are a lot of things that are easy to grow from seed. Herbs are not one of them. It's basil is one that's fairly easy to grow. You can probably also grow dill from seed, but thyme, rosemary, sage, oregano, all those woody things are very difficult to grow from seed. So don't beat yourself up.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that because, yeah, my mint came up. I do have some parsley that came up, and dill, and then basil, but that's pretty much it. I've got 12 pots out there with different kinds.
Well, and when fall comes around, you'll find that cilantro, I always tell people when your basil dies, it's time to plant cilantro. When your cilantro dies, it's time to plant basil. But you're just, not to be insulting in any way, but you're just a good average person. Nobody does very well unless you're a really professional grower and have all the right equipment. Trying to grow these woody things from seed is kind of a joke. They're much more commonly propagated through cuttings than being grown from seed. So, like I say, don't beat yourself up over it. It's probably not the seed. It's probably not you. It's just something that's hard to grow.
Good. All right. One last thing. I trimmed my front hedge a few weeks ago of dwarf, Yelpine holly.
Okay.
And, of course, it looks pretty scraggly still, bare spots. What would I use to, I have Hesgro plant. Do you use that on the hedge or do you use lawn food on the hedge?
Hesgro plant would be an excellent fertilizer. The main difference between a granular fertilizer like Medina's Growing Green and the liquids like the Hesgro plant, the liquids act faster but don't last as long. In other words, if you're relying on a good, you know, let's call it a landscape food rather than just a lawn food, but like the Growing Green product, it's going to take longer for the material to break down into the form the plants can absorb and use, but you would only be putting that on about every 3 to 4 months. The liquid is absorbed and used by the plants much more quickly, but if that's going to be their sole source of nutrition, you want to repeat it after about 3 weeks. Dry 3 months, liquid 3 weeks, but they're both good products. Where you've pruned, and hopefully you didn't, pruning on dwarf yelpine or just about anything, the thing you want to be careful of is don't take too high a percentage of the foliage off at any one time. In fact, I'd recommend that you don't ever take off more than 30 to 40% of the foliage, and that sometimes means you have to prune in more than one stage. So you're going to want to get some foliage back on those things pretty quickly. So I would choose probably to use a liquid fertilizer at this point. Once you're up and looking good, if you want to switch over to the granular so you don't have to do it so often, that's fine too.
Well, I've used granular. Well, when I fertilize the lawn, it gets to the front. I can't get to the back of the hedge. It's up against my house, but the front. I have just used my spreader and let it spray up in there as I go along and do that every 3 months. And this hedge has not really looked good in years.
Has it gotten shadier in that area, or is it just full hot sun?
It's direct sun until 4 p.m, and then the house shades it the rest of the day.
Okay. Yopon would love to have sun all day long. It probably would look prettier. And so many people, you know, planted it when their trees were small, and things have gotten bigger and it's gotten shadier. Again, you know, bring a picture by sometime or something like that. Yopon typically should stay full and bushy, but it may just be not quite as much sun as it likes. And when you water, be sure you're watering very, very deeply. Once it's established, Yopon will tolerate a lot of drought, but it doesn't like it. So the new growth coming out after you prune, take a look and see how it looks and call and tell me how the new growth is looking, and then I can tell you if you need to do anything else. If it were mine, in addition to the fertilizer, I'd probably throw a little bit of azomite on there. I probably would mulch it, and there's some other things, you know, just a layer of mulch not up against the trunks but out away from it to help keep that soil a little cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter, and to retard evaporation. There's some other things you can do that should get the Yopon looking better.
Okay. All right. I've heard you talk about azomite, and how it greens stuff up, and so I thought I might try some of that as well.
Oh, absolutely. It's not terribly expensive, and it's a rock powder, so to speak. There's nothing negative about it. It will never burn. Right now, one of the things that I'm trying to figure out is what is an optimal rate of, or an optimal time of application, because we've seen just amazing results on some things that were pretty badly yellowed, and I don't really have a good answer for you yet on how often you should repeat it, but we're really impressed with it and still figuring out how to use it most effectively.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it, Bob.
Appreciate the call. Get out and have a great Sunday. Thank you so much. All right, we better get a break in here, I guess, and I should be talking to you right now about Wild Birds Unlimited. You know, it's always been one of my favorite stores. It's been a place where I go to do a lot of gift shopping as well, because they not only have, you know, great nature-related products, which in and of themselves make good gifts, but they've got some really unique and different gift merchandise, and they vary it. It just, they always have something new every season. Beautiful things, decorative things for your landscape. I know 1 year they had Soulmate socks, which were a big hit. But Kyle and his staff, they travel widely. They find some great products. And, of course, the Wild Birds Unlimited stock itself is some of the best you will find when it comes to seed and feeders and nesting boxes. The really big news about Wild Birds Unlimited is they have opened a second location. Now, I know Wild Birds Unlimited are franchised, and they're all over the country. But the folks that own the wonderful store out there, near the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner, keeping that store open, but they've also opened a second store on the north end of Burney. Headed out Main Street, you'll get out toward Market, and there's a brew pub out there. But anyway, as you head out, you will see the new Wild Birds Unlimited store. Same great people, same great products, lots of fun new stuff out there, gifts as well as birding products and products for nature in general. Give them a call. I'm not real sure yet. I've got to get out there myself and see what their days and hours are, but I suspect they're open pretty much most days and pretty long hours, just like the original store, which is still going strong there in the shopping center at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner. Name to remember, good people to trust, Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Going to be Robin and Tim and Blake. Robin's first. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I've got a fig tree. Well, okay. It used to be a tree. The yard men came in and cut it to the ground the first year I had it.
Okay.
It's more of a bush now, but mm-hmm. It's never made figs. It's about 5 years old.
How much sun does it get, Robin?
Well, it probably gets 6 hours at least.
Not getting enough sun. Fig trees, they would like, I've got a couple of them, and one, there's an oak tree that's grown up quite large around it, and it's not producing 10% of the figs that it used to. Out in the sun, you'll get a whole lot more figs. I think it's just in an area that's too shady. And figs usually produce best as bushes, by the way. So if there's any pruning or anything you can do to get it more sun, that will most definitely help. If not, it's getting a little late this spring, but you probably want to think about transplanting it out to a sunnier part of the yard, because that's the only way you're going to start getting good production. But figs should be the easiest of all fruit trees to grow, but they want, you know, 10 to 12 hours of sun to really produce for you.
Yeah, it's got some big oaks close by, so it's too big to transplant, really. I couldn't do it.
Well, then get yourself another one, or put a couple of air layers, you know, the process where you kind of gouge a little bit out of the bark, wrap some sphagnum around it, and wrap that up in foil, and it will put roots down, moisten the sphagnum, of course, thoroughly first, and you can kind of make some pre-rooted cuttings. The other thing you can do with a fig tree is where you've got a branch that's really low to the ground, take your knife and kind of skin some of the bark off the bottom of the branch, then pin it down to the ground, bend a coat hanger or something like that that you can jam down over it, pin it down to the ground, put a big scoop of soil on top of it. Within about 3 or 4 months, it will take root at that point, and then you can cut it off just back toward the plant, and you've got a new little fig tree to plant somewhere, and you can make some new plants off of that fig if you can't transplant the mother plant. But if you want figs, you're going to have to plant them in a sunnier spot. It's just that's the good and the bad of it.
Okay, let me go over that again. Find a root that's coming out close to the ground.
No, a limb that is very low to the ground.
Okay. And I know, and I think I've got some of those. And then skin off some of the bark on the underside or the bottom side of that limb
where it will come in contact with the soil. Yeah, and then just pin it down to the ground and put a scoop of dirt on top of it.
Okay. Gotcha.
If that fig had a brain, it would say, oops, I had a limb break that fell on the ground. I better grow some new roots so that that limb can keep on growing. So you're just fooling the plant into thinking that something's wrong. What you're doing is just telling it to form roots at that point. And doesn't take long. You know, in the summer months, it only takes probably 2 or 3 or 4 months, and you'll get a very healthy root system starting out from that point where you skin the bark off of it. And then, like I say, you just cut it just above that point, dig it up, and you've got a whole new plant.
Wow. Okay, that would be fun to try for sure. Okay, is it too late to put out beneficial nematodes?
Never too late to put out beneficial nematodes. In fact, a lot of people do it this time of year and on into the hot summer months for flea and fire ant control. You know, who knows what it's going to be. Some people had lots of June bugs early and hopefully have put out beneficial nematodes to control the grub worms. But the nematodes control a lot of things in addition to the grub. So we use them almost year-round when we start talking about fleas and fire ants and squash bugs and ticks and all sorts of different things that they will control.
Mm-hmm. And on my roses, the leaves are being eaten. Not so much the thrip problem, but the leaves. What would be doing that?
When you look at a leaf, is it like a little round circle has been cut out of the leaf, or is it just chewed on the edges?
It's chewed on the edges.
Okay, it's probably a caterpillar of some sort. Spray a little BT. It'll be totally safe. But there are lots of caterpillars that like to eat the rose leaves. If you ever see what looks like just a little perfect circle cut out from the edge of the leaf, that is a type of, they call them a bee. It's actually it's something related, but they call it a leaf-eating bee. And you can always identify it because it makes a little perfect circle. They're usually here for only a short while, and they're really not worth worrying about. But the caterpillars can be damaging to the buds as well as the foliage. So I'd put out a little BT, and you should control them overnight.
Okay, thank you. One more question. We've got all these old live oak trees, and they're sending up little sprouts around the area. What is the best way to stop that?
Pray for rain. What the live oak is doing is a totally normal thing that it does when it gets stressed. And every live oak in South Texas has been stressed by the drought. They also get stressed where they have root compaction. They can be stressed for a number of different reasons. But having the root sprouts start coming up abundantly just tells you that something is stressing that tree. And it's not anything that you have or haven't done. It's just Mother Nature has not given that tree the water it was hoping for.
Oh, so it's a water situation.
That's the most common cause of stress in live oaks right now. It's just a severe drought we've been in for several years. So that's probably 90% of why you're seeing all the little root sprouts. Could also be a problem, the tree being buried a little too deeply. Could be a number of different things. It could be a nutrient deficiency that is stressing the tree. But root sprouts are a sign of stress, and there are a lot of just natural things in nature that are very stressful for trees. This drought is so bad that up in the hill country, you know, around the area where I live, some of the places the soil is so shallow, and we're seeing 100-year-old trees just fold up and die from the drought, elms, oaks, all kinds of things. So we need a lot more thunderstorms, and they need to be a lot more widespread than the one we got last night, where some people got a good rain, some of us didn't get very much. So, yeah, a virtual lot of the oaks out there are stressed, and most all of them are putting on a whole bunch of little root sprouts.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend.
You do the same, Robin. You do the same. Thank you so much. Okay. Let me look at my log. Yeah, I better get a break in here. Tim, you and Blake will be up next, but looks like I need to take a moment and talk about Dr. Mark Williamson. You know, quality of life just depends on so many things. Having a good, healthy mouth is one of those things that can add years to your life, add a lot of pleasure to your years as well. And everybody needs a good dentist. Let me tell you what, you will not find a better dentist or a nicer office than the office of Dr. Williamson. It's just, they're some of the friendliest people you will ever meet. Dr. Williamson is trained so broadly that he's not like so many of the dentists that just want to send you out to a specialist if it's anything more than just cleaning or a filling or something like that. Dr. Williamson is quite capable of solving just about any dental issue that you might have. He practices sedation dentistry like he and Dr. Staffel pioneered, which enables him to do a lot more work in one sitting. It's just he's going to tailor your needs to the most appropriate way of taking care of things. And he's focused on you. He wants to know you. He wants to know your family. He's not looking forward to the next patient. He's your dentist, and he's going to take good care of you. If you're in need of a dentist, if you're new to the area, consider Dr. Williamson and Associates. Wonderful people, easily located out in Northwest San Antonio, Cherry Ridge Drive, which is just northeast of the intersection of 410 and I-10. Give him a call. I think you'll be very, very impressed with Dr. Williamson and Associates, 341-2569.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and straight back to the phone lines. Going to be Tim and then Blake. Actually, have some open lines, so grab one if you like at 210-599-5555. But right now, good morning, Tim.
Hey, good morning, Bob. How are you?
Off to a good start. It's a little windy, but it's at least it's not hot today. You sure can't complain about the heat.
Yes, sir. So, hey, Bob, this is what I got. I got a 28-year-old magnolia tree.
Okay.
That the leaves started, turning. They looked like they were burnt on the end. It started turning in. I've been working with an arborist that you guys have recommended. Outstanding company to work with.
Good.
Brought them out, and evidently my magnolia is deficient in manganese and nitrogen.
Uh-huh.
So I ordered those Maget injectors. We figured out exactly how many injectors I needed and that sort of thing. So I injected the tree yesterday and everything. Fingers crossed I did it right. My question is, Bob, is there anything else I can be doing for that tree rather than, you know, wait, see if the injectors are going to do
it? Oh, yeah, absolutely. number one, you should have mulch on the surface of the ground 2-3 inches deep over the root zone of that tree. And you don't ever want to trim the lower limbs. A magnolia, when you see a really beautiful one, you'll notice that the limbs go almost all the way to the ground. And that's the tree's attempt to keep the soil a little bit cooler. If the tree has been trimmed or, you know, for whatever reason, it's the root system is not really shaded, then mulch is your best answer to, you know, to keep that soil cooler. I would add, you know, I'd add two things, just the same basic fertilizer you use on other things in your landscape, and I would add azomite. If you do those two things two, three, four times a year, I don't think you'll ever have to worry about injectables again.
Okay. So two, three, four times the azomite times a year. But what kind of other fertilizer? Because they did come out last year and they injected the soil and everything. Mm-hmm. Is there another fertilizer you think I should get specifically for this tree?
Well, I'm not big onto, you know, injecting stuff into the soil. The three good fertilizers that I recommend most highly, one of them is Medina's Growin' Green fertilizer, which is actually certified organic. Maestro Grow makes a fertilizer called Texas Tea. I don't know where Gary DeMasters, who owned the company, then came up with that name, but it is a good fertilizer and based on organic ingredients. The folks at Nature's Creation make a good fertilizer that's built around alfalfa and other natural fertilizer forms. It's called Premium Lawn and Garden Food. I would use one or all of those. I think plants are kind of like people. You don't want to eat the same thing every night. So, you know, I would use different products, just kind of rotate them around. But all three of those are reasonably priced. They're good on everything in your landscape, and your magnolia will love it.
Great. I appreciate it because it's 28 years old and we really don't want to lose it, you know.
Now, what part of town do you live in? Obviously, you've got some fairly deep soil.
Northeast, okay. Actually near Wild Birds Unlimited, you know, off of Heidmer.
Uh-huh. Wow. You've got better soil than most. I used to live out in that area, and some of that area has pretty shallow soil. You obviously are in an area that's got a little bit deeper, a little bit better soil. But as the roots, you know, get further down into the clay, down in the kind of the bad stuff that's out there, fertilizing is going to take on, you know, even more importance. But I really think that mulch on the surface to cool the soil is going to help almost as much as the nutrient material is.
Yes, sir. We got cedar mulch around the tree, but it's not mm-hmm. piled up on the roots.
That's good.
I wanted to make sure it wasn't piled up. And so we do have the cedar mulch around it and everything. So
well, keep adding to it. You know, it ought to be 3 inches deep around there and just not up against the trunk. You're doing it all right. But there's nothing wrong with cedar mulch. I like mulches that have a variety of materials in them. But and obviously cedar is not doesn't grow in the areas where the magnolias really do well, which is going to be Alabama and Mississippi and southern Louisiana. So I'd maybe work some hardwood mulch into that cedar mix. You can actually just kind of blend them up when you put it on the ground. But there's on that type of tree in particular, there's almost no such thing as too much mulch.
Okay. So real quick, how with me doing those injections, when do you guesstimate that I hopefully start seeing the tree turn around a little bit?
You know, I'm a big one on analogies. If you're really sick, you go into the hospital and get IV stuff. If you're not really sick but want to feel better, then you just change your diet a little bit. It really depends on what the specific deficiency is and how long, you know, because the magnolia tree is a big tree, and it takes a little while for things to be used by the tree, and things that are in the soil and taken up takes a little while for the microbes to process them. You should see some change when the new foliage comes out on the tree. That's what you're going to see. The existing leaves are not going to change a whole lot. We're moving into the time of year that you should start seeing new foliage, and that new foliage coming out should look substantially better than the older leaves on the tree.
Okay, good. All right. Well, hey, sir, I appreciate everything. Thank you very much.
You are certainly welcome. I appreciate the call this morning. You get out and enjoy a great Sunday.
All right, sir. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, Tim. Blake, hang on just a second. I'm kind of up against the time wall here. Let me get one more quick break in, and then we'll talk. I get to talk to you about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. And once again, I know you hear roofing ads constantly, and everybody's always reminding you of, oh, all the things that can go wrong with your roof. Why not put on a roof that will last a lifetime? A Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof, they are not that expensive. The workmanship is just unsurpassable. I've got a well over 100-year-old house, 3 chimneys, balcony around, 3 sides upstairs. They put the roof on my home 20 years ago. I've not called them even once with a problem. Not all metal roofs are the same either. Before we knew about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, we had a supposedly reputable company put a metal roof on our Shades of Green nursery, rusted out in about 6 or 7 years, and the company wouldn't stand behind their warranty. Well, by that time, we'd learned about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. They came in and put a really good roof on, and we've never looked back. We had a hail as big as baseballs. Now, it was a little hard on the skylights, but it sure didn't hurt the roof at all. They simply put on the best roof in the business. And if you're one of the folks that have had some storm damage recently, don't spend that insurance money just doing the same old thing again. Put on the last roof you will ever need on your home. You're going to find they're very reasonably priced. Plus, you're going to save money on your utility bill every month. Plus, your insurance company's probably going to give you a nice discount on your homeowner's insurance because they know they're not going to have to replace a roof that Southwest Metal Roofing Systems installed. Find out what I'm talking about. Just to tell you how much I believe what I'm telling you, I signed a contract with them last week. They're going to put a new roof on my barn. My house certainly doesn't need any attention, but they're going to put a new roof, and keeping with historic standards, I just contracted with them to put a great new roof on my barn, and I'm really looking forward to it. Do what I did. Call them at 210-822-6868. 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening. It's going to be Blake and Tommy and Bill. Blake is up first. Good morning, Blake.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Off to a good start. It's a nice, pleasant day out there, that's for sure.
Beautiful. Hey, I've got a couple of philodendrons that I don't want to kill, so I need your help.
What kind of philodendrons?
One is a Paracio Verde, and the other is a Silver Sword.
Okay.
And I noticed they don't take up water very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? I was walking through your greenhouse the other day. I noticed a couple of them have do not water signs on them.
Well, it's not that they don't take up the water so quickly, but, you know, some of these really fancy varieties just don't have the best root systems in the world. And as, you know, and the one thing you want to be real sure you never do is put them in too large a pot. It's probably going to take a while for the roots to really fill out the pots because when they come to us, they never have as good a root system as, you know, I want to see on these things. So, you just want to be sure when you water them, you want to water them thoroughly, but you want to be sure that they have dried to the proper point, that they've got plenty of oxygen in the soil before you water again. And as you repot them over the years, don't ever put a little bitty plant in a great big pot. Always go just slightly larger, and it does not hurt a plant, especially a philodendron. It does not hurt them to be root bound. They're going to grow by far best when they are root bound. Like I say, watch your watering carefully. When you water thoroughly, or even use ice. Ice melts so slowly, it's all absorbed. You don't have a whole lot running through. But just make certain that you've let that soil get dry a couple of knuckles deep before you water again. And that's probably the single most important thing. You also want to give them plenty of light. They don't have to have necessarily direct sunlight, but at the very least, they want very bright, filtered sunlight. Morning sun is fine. But if you get the light right and the watering right, you'll find them pretty easy. But everybody's always tempted putting them into a bigger pot because they think it's going to make them grow faster. It'll actually slow down the growth, and sometimes the plants end up dying because of it.
Mm-hmm. I've got a big split-leaf philodendron outside, and that thing is huge, and it's pretty aggressive. But yeah. These are not. So, and then My other question is, I've got a bromeliad.
Bromeliad.
How do I, a bromeliad.
Okay.
What do you plant those in? Moss or?
And do you know what kind of a bromeliad you have?
I do not. It's green, and then it has the kind of a purple pinkish edges around it. It's pretty small.
Yeah, it's probably a Neorhigelia. There are two basic groups of bromeliads. The majority of the bromeliads are what we call epiphytes. They grow in nature. They grow up clinging to the bark of trees, grow up in, you know, crevices in trees and things like that. Those want to be potted in a very loose, open medium. I've always used just old fir bark. When I repot my orchids and the fir bark's partly broken down, that's what makes an excellent medium for bromeliads. You never, ever want to put them in potting soil. I qualify that just a little bit. There are also terrestrial bromeliads which grow in the soil, and that includes things like pineapples. It includes a pretty little thing they call an earth star or a cryptanthus bromeliad. But most of the others are epiphytes and need to be in a very loose mix. And I'm coming up to news. Let me get Jimmy to put you on hold, and we'll come back. There's a couple of really important things to tell you here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening. We were talking to Blake about bromeliads. We're going to talk a little bit more about that and then move on with more interesting things with Timmy and Bill. But one thing about bromeliads is you were asking what medium they like to grow in. An interesting thing, though, about epiphytic bromeliads is once the plants are mature, they don't grow any new roots. You probably never, ever will have to repot that plant. The life cycle of the bromeliad is such that it starts out growing, reaches a certain point of maturity, and blooms. And once it blooms, the plant slowly begins to deteriorate and die. But as it does so, it produces new little plantlets coming up around the base of the mother plant. That is the only time that bromeliad is going to be growing roots. Once those little plants get well started, the root system basically shuts down. And the only thing the roots in a bromeliad are used for, in the case of the terrestrial bromeliads like you were describing, the only thing they really do is anchor the plant to whatever it is growing in or on. That's the second important thing about bromeliads, is that these epiphytic types pretty much take up most of their water and all of their nutrients, not through the roots, but through the little specialized cells called scales that are kind of down at the base of the leaves. That's why when you water them, many times, I think what you're describing is probably something called a Neorhigelia, but we let the water stand kind of down in the crown of the plant for a little while after we water it, and then pour it out. So,
started dipping it into rainwater.
Yeah, and that's great, but you won't accomplish anything by repotting it. In fact, you know, a lot of people just use a glue gun or something like that and stick it on a piece of wood or something. But as you start taking little plantlets off the base of a plant that's bloomed, that's when your medium's going to be important. And like I say, on the great majority of bromeliads, kind of a bark mix similar to what we would use in orchids or maybe even almost a mulch, but you never want to use potting soil.
Okay, very good. And then one more question. I don't have a lot of space that gets full sun all day, so I wondered what your thoughts are on square foot gardening technique. If it's worth it,
I guess you could say it works, but I would prefer the term common sense gardening. And I'm not crazy about square foot. The folks who came up with the idea from the northeastern part of the country, and quite frankly, you know, it's fine if the plants they talk about in their system are things that you want to eat. But I don't see, you know, growing 10,000 radishes if you don't like radishes and you much prefer planting beans. So if you're trying to maximize your sunny space, you want to plant things, I think, that produce fairly quickly, and things that you get when you you know, look at the size of the plant versus how much production you're going to get from it. You want to sort of maximize that. If you're going to plant peppers, you want to plant something like shishitos that make a huge number of peppers on a small plant. You're not going to plant corn. You're not going to plant okra. You're not going to plant these things where, you know, is one big plant only gives you a small amount of production. So you want to stick with things. I think you're better with bush beans than you are with pole beans, but first of all, make a list of what you really like and, you know, what you want to grow. Make a list of things that you just can't find good quality in the grocery store. And it just, you know, makes it all that much more important to grow your own. And then just use your space efficiently. I think that's better than anything Mel Bartholomew ever came up with.
Perfect. That's exactly what I wanted to know.
And be sure you're planting in the right season, too. I mean, you should be able to harvest something from your garden, you know, every day of the year, both winter and summer. So be sure you understand both, you know, how long it's going to take to produce and when the optimum time to plant it is. Again, and just as an example, you're probably going to plant bush squash rather than vining squash because it doesn't take up nearly as much space. And you're probably going to want to plant the warm season squashes rather than the cool season squashes because they'll produce in 30 to 40 days, whereas the others may take 90 to 120 days. So it's fun. You can't dumb it down to just one set of rules like they try to do in square foot gardening. I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's should be tailored individually according to your space, according to what you like, and, you know, according to what the season is. Given those factors, anything you're not familiar with, call and ask questions about it. We'll more than happily get you started down the right road there.
All right. Excellent. Sounds good. I'm going to get out and enjoy this beautiful weather.
You do it, Blake. And I appreciate the call this morning. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, John.
Certainly. Goodbye. All right. Next in line, let me check this and be sure. I believe that is going to be Tommy. Yes, it is. Tommy and then Bill and then Kim. Good morning, Tommy.
Yes, Bob. This I've got a question. We're in Rockport right now.
Lucky
and my
you.
Wife bought yeah, yesterday was hot.
Say hi to Jay Watkins and tell him to go catch me some trout.
We tried it. This wasn't right. No.
Yeah.
A little windy today. But my question is, she bought about a 4.5-5-foot palm tree, Mexican palm, I believe they call it.
Okay.
The ones that grow around here. Now, we're going to transplant it to San Antonio. Is that going to be, is that okay to buy a tree over here and move it to San Antonio?
Well,
we're not transplanting. Bought it. It's in a nursery. Bought it from a nursery.
Okay. Is it in a pot already, or was it growing in the ground?
No, they pull it out of a pot. It's got about an 18-inch ball.
Okay. The time you transplant palms is during hot weather. If you're just taking it out of a pot and putting it into the ground, you can do that, obviously, 365 days a year. But if this was a bald and burlap plant or a plant that was dug one place and being moved to another, you don't do that in March. You do that in July or August. That's just contrary to most woody plants that we transplant in the cool part of the year. When you cut the roots on a palm tree, they die all the way back to the trunk of the palm, and they start over making new roots. If you do that in the cool season, the roots just don't get started very well. When you do that in the heat, they regrow almost immediately. So that's one consideration. The second is that the so-called Mexican fan palms, there are two forms of them. They're called Washingtonia is their technical name. One of them is Robusta, one of them is Filifera. There's one variety that is not hardy in San Antonio, much more susceptible to cold damage. And the other one, if we get as cold a winter as we got in 2021, is not going to be real happy. And the other thing about a single trunk palm, like your Mexican fan palm, the only part of that palm that is really alive is right up at the top of the plant where the new fronds are produced. If that part of the palm freezes, it does not come out from the base. It does not come out from the side. It just simply folds up and dies. And so I guess I'm in a nice way trying to say that's not the palm that I would choose for San Antonio. In San Antonio, if you can find what's called a windmill palm, if you want an upright palm that gets pretty tall, you want the windmill palm. It's going to be by far the most hardy. If you want one that doesn't get quite as tall, there's one called the Sabal, S-A-B-A-L palm, is a real good choice. And if you want something that's lower, and this one actually does branch from the base, you want what they call a Mediterranean fan palm or shamrocks. Those are the three palms that you can count on doing well year after year. The Mexican fan palms, virtually every one of them in San Antonio died in 2021. So they're beautiful plants. If you have a really protected area in your yard, they grow fast. They grow twice as fast as some of the others. But look in your crystal ball and see what the weather's going to be like for the next 10 years, and I can tell you whether it's a really good choice or not.
Well, that's what I thought, because they're growing crazy around here at Rockport, but
oh, yeah.
San Antonio gets cold weather, and we have a couple of the palms that are huge. They're probably 50 years old. Mm-hmm. And she bought one of those. But a Mexican palm is not cold hardy, is what you're saying.
Well, it's less cold hardy. You know, if it never gets, it's not going to be hurt by 32 degrees. But at 22 degrees, some of them are going to be damaged. At 12 degrees, most of them are going to die. So it just really depends on where you're going to plant it.
Okay, so she already bought it, so I can go ahead and put it in the ground anytime, right? It's okay. It's come
if
out
it's,
of a pot.
Yeah,
or
if it
whatever.
Came out of a pot, it can certainly go in the ground. I would plant it on the south side of a building if you can, somewhere that is protected from the cold north wind. It's just, you know, if we go back, and I never use word normal when I talk about Texas weather, but if we go back to more typical winters, it's probably going to be good for you for 10 or 20 years. But we've had weather that's cold enough to hurt it 3 out of the last 3 years. And if you've got a crystal ball that can tell me accurately what's going to happen this next winter, it would be very, very useful to me.
That would be great, because I wish I had it, because yesterday it was hot and crazy. And today we're in Rockport and it's cold and they got to have a jacket. So, yeah, I don't have that crystal ball. I appreciate everything, Bob. I can go ahead and plant it. That's the main concern. It's not going.
That is the main concern. But don't make it the center of your landscape, because we may get a winter cold enough to harm it. And the only part that's alive, if that little crown right up in the top of the palm, if that freezes, the whole tree's dead.
Right. Exactly. I think that's what we have at the farm. They're as tall as the high line, those TPS lines, and they've been 50 years. So. Yep. I don't know what they're called, but they're real. One of them looks like a telephone pole, but up on top you see the crown up there, and that's where all the fans come out. So
quite likely is that is probably one of the windmill palms if it's been around that long.
Yeah, it's been around a long time. Okay,
very good.
All right, well, that's all I got, Bob. I appreciate everything you do. All right,
I appreciate the call this morning, and thank you, sir. Okay.
I'll try to catch you through.
I look forward to it. And if you run into Jay Watkins, I mean, if you're looking for the best guide on the coast, check him out. He's down in the Rockport area, and has been a while, but I fish with him a number of times, and we always come back with more fish than anybody else at the dock. So if you're looking for a good guide down there, tell him I said hello.
I will. Thank you, Bob. Bye-bye.
Yes, sir. Thank you. All right, Jimmy, I guess we better get a break in here. I've got all the lives done, so let's get the recordings done, and we'll be back to gardening.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and once again, we've got some open lines. It alternates between every line taken, you get a busy signal, and a couple of open lines, and you get through when you call. So it'd be a good time to dial 210-599-5555. We're going to talk to Bill and then to Kim. Bill's first. Good morning, Bill.
Hey, Bob, long time. Up here in Blanco.
I recognize that voice and remember the floods and remember all our gardening questions over the years. How can I help you?
Well, I've got a Christmas cactus that put one bloom on last week. Now I've got it 9 blooms. And it bloomed like crazy, like it's supposed to, starting in November. Is this normal?
Normal is a real strange word, and it rarely applies to anything in the world of gardening or weather. It's not typical, but It's certainly possible. The so-called Christmas cacti, which are basically epiphytic cacti, they're not desert cacti, but they bloom according to day length. And the ones that we call Christmas cacti, typically, if they're getting not any artificial light at night, they bloom around December or so. The ones they call spring cactus tend to bloom more like March and April, when the nights are a little bit shorter, the days are a little bit longer. And it's certainly possible that, you know, a Christmas cactus can bloom earlier or later, that a spring cactus can do the same thing. And they look identical and their growth is identical. But if it did the same thing year after year, then I'd say you've got a very special plant that blooms over a much longer than usual period of time. But I think it's probably just due to some of the weird weather we've had and maybe where you've had it growing. Like I say, I wouldn't call it abnormal, but it's certainly not typical to have them rebloom like that.
Well, it's about an eight-year-old plant, and it's never done this before. Mm-hmm. And it sits in our sunroom, which gets the morning east sun.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, that was just strange to me. My next question is, a lot of people, I'll listen, sometimes they try to describe a plant to you, and, you know, that's almost like you'd have to be God to know what they're talking about sometimes. But there's a free app out there called Picture This, and
uh-huh.
it's free. Mm-hmm. And you take a picture of the plant, and it tells you what it is, just like I took some seeds when I visited my son at St. Croix.
Uh-huh.
And this thing finally grew, and it's called a silk plant.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know what it was. And then I was given this oak tree, and I thought it was a bur oak, but I forgot the name. But, like, it's not a chinapic, but it started with a C, mm-hmm. like Charlie. And so for those people, if they have a question, they ought to download that app.
Now, well, and just keep in mind, Bill, that app is not 100% accurate. I've seen it. I've used it. I've looked at a lot of different things. And I would say that probably 90% of the time it's going to give you the right answer, but don't bet the farm on it because it gets a little confused every now and then. It's not foolproof.
Okay. Well, it kind of gives you a better idea, just like all these big yellow flowers we got.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, they call it bastard cabbage. You know,
uh-huh.
they're going crazy over here.
Yep.
And, of course, I had no clue what it was. But my
And lots of times, let me just tell you one or two other things. Lots of times they give you the common name but not the botanical name. And if you really want to trace something down, you know, you need the botanical name. But the other thing, since you're a person who enjoys the out of doors, check out the app sometime called Merlin, Merlin. That's another one of those really remarkable things. You hear a bird song and you think, I wonder what that is. And you push the thing on your phone and hold it up and it'll say, well, you're hearing a blue jay, a mockingbird, and probably a lesser goldfinch all at the same time. And it does the same thing. And it is absolutely amazing how accurate it is most of the time. So along with Picture This, Merlin's another great one to know about.
I appreciate that. My main question really is, you know, like you heard told the other person, how many 100-year-old pecan trees have died during the last 2.5 years drought?
Mm-hmm.
My main question, I lost probably 10, 50-year-old pecan trees, but on some of my pecan trees, one half of the tree put out leaves. The other half isn't. Does that mean next year it's going to totally die too because whatever happens?
No, it doesn't, unless it turns out that one half of the tree is so much heavier that it breaks up in a storm. But we've seen this on a number of trees, and not just pecan trees, but seen it on several different kinds of oak trees, several different kinds of fruit trees. And it's hard to explain why. I know in some of the trees when I look at it, and it's the north half of the tree that is not coming out, it's obviously cold damage. And we've seen that, you know, on a number of different things. On others, you know, it's the roots that are on one side of a tree are the main source of nutrients to the limbs and leaves on that side of the tree. Not 100%, but sometimes if you've got, because of weird soil conditions or whatever, one side of that tree the root system is getting a lot more water than the other side is. You do something weird in the geology of the area, and the side of the tree that was getting the more moisture came through the winter just fine. The side of the tree that was getting the less moisture isn't coming out nearly as well, if it's coming out at all. So there are a lot of different things that can cause that, but you're sure not the only one seeing it.
Oh, I know. It's sad. It's so sad. I got just thought another question, because I know sometimes you say don't use compost or stuff. I have some turkey compost, and I was thinking about when I plant some of my tomato plants or whatever, can I mix some of that in with my sandy loam soil, or would that
be absolutely
a good idea?
No. Okay. Right. And you know, some compost, including some poultry litter compost, is very strong, so to speak, and there's no doubt that it's probably better to let it age a little bit, but that's much more true of chickens than it is of turkeys. Turkeys, it's not as hot, would be the way that some people would say it. So, but even then, if you can compost it for a few months before you use it, it's excellent, excellent fertilizer, and that's not an absolutely mandatory thing. But if you're growing anything that's a little sensitive, yeah, you probably want to pick some of the older manure that you use on those particular plants.
Well, yeah, I bought this compost. It looks very composted to me. Yeah.
Oh, very good.
There's a company here in Blanco that sells it, and I know always turkey to me, well, like chicken, if it's good and dried, it's great nitrogen. But anyway, I'll let you go. Got to run to church. God bless you, and we'll see you again down the line.
I look forward to it, Bill. Thank you so much for the call this morning. Yep.
I'm leaving for St. Croix Tuesday.
You have fun down there.
Yeah.
I'm a little jealous. That would be a great relaxing place to go. So you enjoy it, and glad you get to be with family down there.
Yeah, my Marine son. All right.
That's the perfect thing. Thank you, Bill. Bye. All right, let's see. Yeah, let's take one more call before we take a break, and that would be Kim. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Bob. I have a quick question about a product that I recently saw in the Old Farmer's Almanac Garden Guide.
Okay.
Wondering if you have heard of it or used it or anyway. It's called Grub Gone. I know you recommend the nematodes on the blue sponge, which I'm having a really hard time finding down here on the coast in our area. And when I look at this, it seems like its active ingredient is a BTG.
Right.
So it's the Bacillus thuringiensis. I don't know. The G is G-A-L-L-E-R-I-A-E.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
Last summer we came home from South Carolina and we're just sort of, you know, blowing off the sidewalk, and all of a sudden the grass just started to blow off.
Yep.
And as we further investigated, we were wishing we had the second best patch of grass, not the first best.
Right. The problem is that is primarily designed for a different type of grub, something they have more in the northern part of the country. I don't think you'll find that it works very well here. The same thing is true other parts of the country. People swear by grub control with something called milky spore fungus, and it works really, really well if you live in Missouri, and it doesn't work at all in South Texas. So it might give you some help, but it's certainly not a panacea. The nematodes are just something that the grub worms can't build up a defense against. And yes, it has been harder to find the ones that come on the little blue sponge, but even the dry ones that you get, I think those are going to be better than the product that you're talking about.
Okay. That's why I called you. Because we just finished, we got a sod cutter and we cut the rye out that we had been growing all winter because we didn't want to put it on top because it was getting too tall. It would have been
right.
The height would have worked out. So the second part of my question would be, so first to back up, the one that I can just order, like where we've been ordering and it has worked so well, the little wasp, the Trichogramma wasp, oh my gosh. In 2 years' time, Mom has gone from seeing so many of those tent caterpillars and then having absolutely no pecans to not seeing one this year because she's got really good out. Every two to 3 weeks in February, she's been putting them out.
And that's the secret to it. You have to make multiple applications, but that's what all the big pecan growers are doing. The pecan growers have all pretty much sold their sprayers. Everybody's gone to using the Trichogramma because they work so well.
Oh, yeah, that has worked fabulous. And that same company that she's been purchasing those from does sell the nematodes, but they're not on the blue sponge.
Yeah, They would be better than this other thing that you read about in the magazine. I still think the blue sponge is best, but that company basically sold out to another firm that instead of being Colorado Springs is in Oregon. And they quite frankly are having problems keeping up. Hopefully they'll get their production deficiencies worked out, shall we say. But in the meantime, the dry nematodes that you're describing, I think those are going to give you a better job. They may not be quite as good as the ones on the blue sponge, but they're okay.
Okay, and then as far as timing, we never actually saw June bugs, like under our house or around our house. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, we had this problem. And then the neighbors across the street recently put a pool in and all that. Anyway, I think that we didn't really have it because we just never saw them. So as far as that goes, just timing, just go ahead. Since we just put new sod down, we went ahead and went with your recommendation for full sun. And I put down the floor and we put that down just last weekend. So at this point, is it okay to go ahead and start giving it some of the growing green?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Growing green is, you can even put it down before you put the sod down. So we don't have to wait with the slow-release organic products like you do with that synthetic fertilizer. So, no, it is fine to put it down this afternoon.
Okay. And then the last question. I've got because we rolled up all of the soil that we cut. That mm-hmm. is just, I mean, every year on this 450-square-foot thing, I've been putting down that Nature's Creation compost. It's beautiful dirt. Mm-hmm. And the grass is already starting to die off because as soon as it hit 80 degrees, that rye started kind of dying off. Anyway.
Right.
Is there anything that I can add to that besides the soil activator or the molasses to help break that down so that I can then just turn around and use that almost like it's the compost that I put down?
I think if you use the molasses, you don't need to use anything else.
Okay.
The one thing that you might do is get a little bit of good quality compost and then sprinkle that in because you're going to sort of be inoculating the soil with a heavy dose of microbes if you get some good fresh compost, and then the molasses is just going to kick things into high gear. So I don't think if you want to, you could go buy one of these products they call Compost Activator, which is basically just, a collection of the microbes. But if you have a good source of just a shovel full of good compost, that'll accomplish the same thing and won't cost you a penny.
All righty. Well, I appreciate your information. Thank you very much.
You are certainly welcome, Kim. Appreciate the call. Jimmy, let's get a break in here, and we'll be right back with more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to the gardening and back to the phone lines. My next two callers are Jody and Gary. Jody's first in line. Good morning, Jody. Hi, Jody.
I'll put him back on hold.
Okay. Need to be listening to the telephone, not the radio. You'll be several seconds behind. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Last weekend, you said something about using cornmeal, soaking it, and then putting it around your oak trees.
Right.
Soak it overnight. How much in a 5-gallon bucket do you do, and about how far from the base out do you go?
Good questions. The ratio is 2 cups. Roughly, I don't measure it. It doesn't have to be exact, but around 2 cups of cornmeal per 5-gallon bucket of water. And remember, it needs to be just, natural cornmeal, not this fancy baking stuff, because they've polished away all the good stuff on that, but just whole ground or stone ground. And what it does, it grows a beneficial fungus called Trichoderma, which takes care of many damaging fungi, including the one that causes oak wilt. So you soak it in the water. Generally speaking, we're finding that oak trees take up most of their liquid and therefore we take up most of the benefit within 10 feet of the trunk of the tree. So even if you've got a pretty big tree, you may want to do more than one bucket to go all the way around the tree. But somewhere, you know, in that 10 to 12 foot range away from the trunk, that's where you're going to get the maximum benefit.
Okay, and do I need to get the leaf matter and stuff? This is on my ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Away from it, or just
no.
Put it on top like this.
No, just put it on top. Just put it on top. What you're doing is growing this Trichoderma fungus, and it'll grow right through and around and over the leaves, and no reason at all to try to get it down to bare soil. Now, if you had leaves 18 inches thick or something like that, yeah, I probably would pull them back a little bit. But in general, even though we had a pretty heavy crop of leaves this year, just right on the surface is fine.
Okay, one last question on it. How did you apply it? Did you use a 5-gallon bucket with holes in the bottom and pour it in and walk around it, or did you spray?
I basically put it in a bucket and just dump it around, just slosh it around here and there. It doesn't necessarily have to be absolutely evenly done. And you're wanting the volume of water, so I guess spraying the water would go further, but you get more benefit from a little bit higher concentration. So basically, I just tip the bucket over and start pouring.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for all the information that you give us.
You know, it is my pleasure doing it, and I thank you for the phone call. You get out and have a great Sunday.
You too, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. All right, let's try Jody once again and see if we're ready. Jody, are you there?
No, we got Bobby next, sir.
Okay, Bobby and Robert next. Good morning, Bobby.
Hey, good morning, Bob. How you doing?
Good. Off to a good start. How about yourself? Sound like you're on the road.
So I am. Yeah, I'm heading down to see if we got any rain. But my question today is seed dormancy. I've had a hard time to get any sunflowers to grow.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I haven't had any, and I planted them. This will be the fourth year in a row. I've planted them maybe too deep, not so deep, on top of the surface, and I haven't had any luck whatsoever.
Are you planting?
I heard you. Yeah.
Is this like a field that you're planting for doves, or is this ornamental sunflowers for your yard?
Oh, no. These are native sunflowers for doves.
Okay. Be sure that your seed is really fresh, and I found that you get a much higher percentage of germination, you know, if you give them smaller seed. We just kind of mix up the Garrett juice, spread the seed on a piece of parchment, and spray it. Sunflower seeds are big enough that you could soak them, not for a long time, but maybe a 10-minute soak in a Garrett juice solution, a couple of ounces to a gallon, and that seems to do about the best for increasing the rate of germination. Now, sunflowers, we don't need to drill them too deeply, but they don't seem to do real well just on the surface of the ground. I think, the problem is that everything in the world wants to eat them. But if you've got a grain drill and you can get them started maybe an inch deep, that's probably going to be pretty much ideal. But the Garrett juice soak, and I think it's probably the acetic or the apple cider vinegar that's in there, is probably the agent that really seems to get seeds to germinate a little bit better. But and you can buy what they sell as Garrett juice, or you can go to dirtdoctor.com and get the recipe, so to speak, and make it yourself. Not very expensive, and it doesn't take a whole lot of it to do a lot of sunflowers.
Okay, yeah, that was going to be my question. I thought I heard you mention the Garrett juice on some other seed. I don't know what it was, but now mm-hmm. when I do that right prior to planting in the fall.
Yeah, oh yeah, I would okay. soak it, and then as soon as it's dry enough to plant, go ahead and put it out.
Gotcha. All right, I'm going to give it a try.
Yeah, now I wouldn't wait till fall. You know, sunflowers are more of a hot weather crop, and they're coming up all over the place right now. You wait till that seed, that soil starts cooling down, you may be a little bit late. I'd probably have them planted, if you're looking towards September 1st, I'd probably have them planted by early to mid-July.
Okay, I was told that they need to overwinter to break down some of that dormancy.
Well, but that's what the garage you should take care of.
I got you. All right, I'm going to give that a shot.
Let me know how it works for you.
All right. I will let you know. Thanks, Bob.
I look forward to it. You're certainly welcome. Thank you. And let's see here. Let's talk to, I think we've got time to talk to Robert here. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I have what looks like to be an invasive ground cover in my grass area. It's very low, very thick green with a very small yellow five-leaf flower on it.
Right.
And it's really growing everywhere.
Mm-hmm. If I wouldn't have anything in my yard if I didn't have that. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's they call it straggler daisy. And it grows well in the cooler weather. Generally speaking, if you have St. Augustine, or especially if you have Bermuda, if it's healthy, it will choke it out once it really gets started growing. But straggler daisy just takes off earlier in the spring than anything else does. It's hard to control. Again, if your grass is thick enough, just mowing it, St. Augustine will dominate it. Good, strong Bermuda will dominate it. But there's no spray that you can use that won't hurt your other grass. And the stuff is the devil to try to pull it out. Wait till your soil is really moist. And you can pull it out of flower beds, but out on the lawn, it's tough. I think your best bet is to just try to keep your basic grass as healthy as possible, maybe a little extra fertilizer, maybe a little extra water. But, yeah, if you want to look it up, it's called straggler daisy, and it is one tough little native spreading plant.
Yeah, the only good news is that it is green, and it doesn't grow too high, so it's at least it creates a carpet back there. Luckily, it's in my back rather than in my front yard. So.
Yeah. And with the drought that we've had for, you know, several years ongoing now, just about everybody has some of it. And those of us who, you know, live on a well and don't really have the water to give the grass as much water as it wants, is truly one of the most dominant things in the landscape. But it is weaker than St. Augustine. It is weaker than Bermuda. And if you can water and fertilize adequately, either of those grasses will ultimately choke it out. But if we get into another summer like the past couple have been, I think you'll be thankful that you have the straggler daisy, because your grass is going to struggle.
Amen to that. Well, at least now I know what it is, and you know, might just have to. We'll be living together for a while.
Well, and as much as we may not like it, there are actually people planting it as a ground cover. It's something we get calls for here in the nursery, and we have one grower that actually produces it in 4-inch pots. So a weed is simply what you define it to be, and what one person calls a weed, the other person may call a lawn. So it's now you know what it is, and like I say, anything you can do to support your other grasses will help suppress it.
Yeah, well, very good. Okay, well, that's the big story, big question for today.
Very good. You get out and enjoy, and we'll talk again. And Jimmy, let's get our last break of the show in, and we'll come back with a couple more.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Hey, the sun just came out there. The wind's still blowing, and it's still chilly, but golly, it's going to be a gorgeous day. Hope you're planning to spend as much of the afternoon outside as you possibly can. I know I certainly am. Of course, in this business, I don't have a lot of choice. It looks like our next two callers, and maybe all we can get into the show today, but Teresa and Robert. Teresa is up first. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. I
have a really quick question. My daughter and her family moved to Boise and bought a new house, and the builder put a choke cherry tree in the backyard. Mm-hmm. They have a child and a dog that will eat anything. Mm-hmm. And depending on the website, it says they're toxic and some say they're non-toxic. So I don't know. She wants to know if they should remove that tree from their backyard.
I doubt it. You know, again, that's not a tree that grows in this area, so I can't claim a whole lot of firsthand experience. But here's what you do is call a veterinarian up there in that area and say, do you see any problems with this? Because I had somebody actually fairly irate that, you know, about some of the plants out there that weren't labeled as, you know, possibly toxic to dogs because they'd read about it on the internet or something. And my response to that was, well, gosh, you know, I've had the pleasure of working with Dr. Kirby for a lot of years, and I've never heard of a dog having a problem with that plant. So rather than take my word as definitive, and I don't think it is that toxic at all, but tell her to find a good veterinarian up there, and I'm sure if she has pets, she needs a good veterinarian anyway, but call the vet and say, how many examples of toxicity have you seen from a choke cherry, you know, in your years of practice? And he's either going to say, oh, I see that once a week, or he's going to say, I've never seen a problem with that. And that's the answer that I would trust. Don't pick the youngest veterinarian on the block either. Pick somebody like Dr. Kirby, who's not very old, but is very experienced. How's that for a nice way of putting it?
Okay, that will work. She did ask someone at a nice nursery here, and he said that she could use Florel Fruit Eliminator, which she didn't get. And when I Googled that, it said it was, you know, kind of not a good chemical to use.
Well,
anyway.
No, and I wouldn't think it necessary, and it, probably the chemical would be far more toxic to the family and the dog than the choke cherry is going to be. So no, I wouldn't go at it that way. I don't think it'll work very well anyway, but you know, when you talk to a veterinarian, find out and call me back. I'll be very interested in knowing, and I'll ask Dr. Kirby. He'll be in within minutes here if you want to keep listening to his show, but he's a Corpus Christi boy originally, so we probably don't, neither one of us know much about what grows in Idaho.
Okay, well, I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your call, and I hope you get a chance to go visit, because I've heard it's a pretty part of the world.
Well, I'm actually up here right now.
Oh, very good.
Oh, yeah. All right.
All right. We'll look forward to hearing back from you, Teresa. Thank you so much. And next up is Robert. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Oh, pretty good. I wanted to get your advice about revitalizing an old St. Augustine lawn that's partially died out, and it gets west-facing sun in the evenings and just burns in the summer.
Okay.
A contractor gave me an estimate to scrape out the entire yard and come back in with a St. Augustine Pro Vista. And I wondered about the Pro Vista strain. Is that any
better? I'm not familiar with that, but I can't imagine, you know, and with the water situation what it is, I would be very reluctant to invest that kind of money in totally resodding it. Two things. That I would recommend, number one, put down a good organic fertilizer, and number two, and do this immediately, get some good compost and put about a half inch layer of compost over the area. You've got to get the compost on before it gets really hot. And right now, this next few days is going to be a real breath of fresh air, literally as well as figuratively. But when we start getting into June and July, it's going to be too hot to be putting compost out. So those are the two things that will do more to revitalize that lawn than anything else. I might put out some beneficial nematodes just in case the June bugs have been out there laying eggs, but I tell you, unless you're, you know, planning on hosting the wedding of the century, I cannot imagine spending the money that it would cost to remove what's there and put down more grass that you're not sure Saws is going to let you water once the summer gets here. So that's strictly your choice, but I've seen an awful lot of very bad-looking yards really turned around with compost and fertilizer.
Okay, I'll try that. I'm also eliminating some wider areas and making it xeriscape around the edges and and other plants that'll look better.
That's always a good idea. Ground covers, there's some wonderful drought-tolerant ground covers, take very little water. It doesn't necessarily have to say xeriscape to be a good plant, but there are salvias, there are kufias, there are things like your skullcap, Blackfoot daisy, Zexmania. There are plants out there that will be absolutely gorgeous. One thing about it, if you put down gravel or rock or anything like that, absolutely do not put anything underneath it. These weed block fabrics, number one, they don't stop the weeds, and number two, they just totally destroy the soil underneath them, and plants will not grow well if they're planted through just a hole in weed block. So no plastic, no weed block, but beyond that, good plants that will tolerate drought are an excellent idea.
Okay. I'll go that direction. Thank you, sir.
Very good, sir. Well, you get out and have a wonderful afternoon, and I know we will talk again. Only got about 35 or 45 seconds left here until the top of the hour news. Dr. Kirby will be in right after that with your pet's health, so you might give a call, think of any questions that you've got, whether it's a dog or a cat or a turtle or a bird. Or it's the one thing that's tough is cat psychology. He said that's the shortest book ever written is what we know about cat psychology. But he's here and ready to answer your questions, and we'll be back right after news. We'll go back to gardening early Saturday morning next week, and we'll look forward to visiting with you then. It's going to be a great day to get out, put out that fertilizer, put out that compost, and join us again next time here on KTSA San Antonio.